Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester is our first guest. We have been having lengthy discussions here on Insight about the rise in gun violence across the country and in California. In preparation for my conversation with the chief, I wanted to get a grasp of the weight of homicides the city of Sacramento is investigating and grieving. At the forefront of our minds is the deadly shooting in downtown Sacramento that killed six people. Just this past weekend, another deadly shooting in Natomas that killed two men. But that's just the past 2 weeks. Last year, there was a nearly 31% increase in murders within city limits. So far this year, there have been a total of 12 homicide investigations claiming 18 lives. That means more than one person killed a week so far this year in the city of Sacramento. Chief Lester has been with Sacramento Police for 28 years, and this is her first year as chief, the first woman to lead the department. And with the change in command comes a fresh or evolved approach to curbing gun violence. Here to share that perspective is Chief Lester. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for making the time. We're going to get into a deeper conversation in just a moment. But first, I just want to lay out the developments from the mass shooting in downtown Sacramento, because this is being updated constantly, and I think it's difficult for people to keep up. So understanding that this is an active investigation, you're limited in what you can say. The latest piece of information came yesterday. You're searching for a suspect whom your investigators believe is one of at least five shooters. That person's whereabouts are unknown. What should the public know?
Well, thank you for asking. Yes, we put out additional information yesterday, and we understand how important and how significant this is to not only the city and our community, but we've had national attention and really been put in the national spotlight, really when we're talking about gun violence here. The information that we put out yesterday was because we had really exhausted all leads that we have on the law enforcement side. So we are asking for our community's help. If anyone knows or has seen or has connections or might be able to provide us some information to, get Mr. Payton into custody.
Investigators believe, when reading the press release, that there are two separate incidents involving this suspect. The first involved domestic violence, a call that happened the afternoon prior. He was not at the home then, but investigators believe he is also one of the shooters that night in downtown. How was your department, how were your detectives able to make that connection?
Well, he is a named suspect in a domestic violence incident that occurred the day before, and an arrest warrant was obtained for that incident. So we knew who he was that Saturday. However, it was, later on in the investigation when we realized that he's also connected with the shooting later in the evening. And what I think is really important for the public to recognize is that this is an issue that our department has been very cognizant of and very much working on, since the beginning of the year. And we see, not only an increase in gun violence, but especially during the pandemic, saw a increase in domestic violence. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but that has also been a priority for our department. And we do realize that those two types of violence do intersect. Mm-hmm. And so we've been working on different strategies to address both of those issues within our region. And we're seeing these increases nationally, like you had said.
Yeah. And so far, this is the third suspect that your detectives believed opened fire that evening. The other two are brothers. One is in the hospital recovering from injuries sustained during that shooting. Has he been released from the hospital?
No, he's still in the hospital, and he is in our custody. He will be booked into the main county jail, but we need to, make sure he's treated for his injuries beforehand. And as of right now, we don't have a date, when to expect that. However, he is in custody and will be pending booking, as well as further review by the district attorney. And we've been working every day with our district attorney's office on this incident to make sure that we are moving forward in the right direction, and we are doing really what they need us to do to present a viable case. And like I have said repeatedly before, our top priority is really to seek justice for the victims and the families of the victims. And the best thing that we can do now for them is to make sure that we have a very comprehensive and thorough investigation and work in partnership with our law enforcement partners, including the district attorney's office, who will take these cases forward.
Right. I want to go back to another arrest that happened last week. There was a fourth person that was taken in custody the day after the shooting. He has since made bail, no longer mentioned in press releases or press updates that include the other three suspects we just talked about. Why is that?
Well, a lot of the questions that we've been getting have been around who actually is responsible or who we believe might be responsible for the shooting. So we're being very cognizant of that and trying to address the community's concerns. Certainly, he has been involved with this, and we have not shied away from sharing information about him or, you know, what information we have at this point. I would like to say that this is an ongoing investigation. As you saw, and as everyone in Sacramento saw, very early on, there were some social media video that came out, and you know, I really appreciate the media's coverage of that because I think it painted a picture to show how complicated, complex, how difficult this scene is and how many people were involved. And so I wanna make sure that the public's really clear that as we move forward in the investigation and continue to work with our partners, including the district attorney's office, you know, we are looking at, you know, other potential charges and working with the district attorney for filing decisions. So what we have now really are preliminary charges, and these will be reviewed further and much, you know, very extensively by our district attorney.
Yeah. And the reality that this is an ongoing investigation, this is all preliminary. How is your department able to confidently say there are at least five shooters in this incident?
We have a lot of evidence, and I really have to thank the public for their help on this. We opened up a citizen evidence portal, which was one of the side products of our body-worn camera system. And we have received over 200 videos, tips, photos, and our investigators are going through all of that information right now and continuing to find and work on identifying people that may have been at the scene, may have been involved. You know, we're continuing, honestly, to ask for anyone who was there, even if they don't think they have something that's relevant to the investigation, to please come forward, because it helps us really understand what happened that night. And we've actually even gotten some help from the FBI, and we're using an analyst from the FBI to continue to work through tips and, you know, additional information. So I'm really proud of the work and the help that we've gotten from the public in regards to helping us solve this case. I think it really speaks to the public's concern over an incident like this and their willingness to help out.
Yeah. I mean, just the enormous volume that your detectives are sifting through. Receiving images is one thing, verifying them, logistically organizing them by place and timeline, not to mention connecting faces with names, is another lift in and of itself. With 28 years in the department, 26 of which wearing a badge, can you remember a crime scene and evidence of this magnitude? There were more than 100 shell casings left at the scene.
I don't during my tenure here, and we have unfortunately have experienced some significant events, you know, during my tenure here. Before I started, there was the Good Guys shooting. And if you're a longtime Sacramento resident, you remember that happening. And then I was personally involved with several shootings, including the Ferguson incident and Solstice incident during my tenure here. But as far as something of this magnitude, no, I don't remember having seen something like this here locally in our city. But what I would like to, you know, make sure that people recognize, well, this incident is, of course, very significant, and there's a large number of victims. Gun violence occurs in this city every single day in our neighborhoods. And that's really concerning. And you don't maybe always hear about, like, those individual instances, or maybe there's a little coverage on the news and then we move on. But to me, as the police chief, it's really concerning because, you know, we have so much victimization that goes on in our communities that are already disenfranchised. It's just really a terrible state of events. And, you know, as this investigation moves forward, I'd like to just address another thing that you had brought up. You know, one of my goals here is to be very transparent about what we're sharing, because one, I know this incident and really all incidents concerning violence are a concern to our community. And so we are working very hard to put as much information out without compromising the case. And I'd like to thank you for recognizing really how complex this is when you're trying to associate, you know, people at the scene with maybe what their role is and trying to identify them. It is a ton of work, and we will not put information out unless, you know, we really have a high level of confidence about what we're sharing, because we want to be absolutely fair and paint the picture in the right way. And I really have to credit a team of incredible investigators that have been on this case nonstop since, you know, the incident happened, and have been working as a team, and really have been relentless in their pursuit of trying to identify leads, witnesses, you know, potential suspects, and do the follow-up. The pressure is for sure significant because people want answers. And to me, it's really important to have a case that has integrity. And so I'm very thankful to them, even under these very difficult circumstances, of continuing to work through, you know, a very good process to, you know, really bring forward a case that can be prosecuted effectively.
In recent days, in press releases, your detectives believe the shooting was triggered by an affiliation with local street gangs. Does that change your view of this mass shooting, or does the investigation change?
Well, I think it's a level of detail that helps us understand really maybe some of the motives behind the shooting, because that is a big question. But I think it begs a bigger question that we should be talking about, right? Not just looking at this incident, but right now, you know, people are asking the why. Why does this happen? How could this have happened? What do we do differently? And I think that's really the conversation that we as a community need to have, right? You know, gun violence, and there's lots of discussion right now about changing the laws, about release of offenders, about, you know, gun control. You know, those are all appropriate conversations for sure. But I think it's really important for us to talk about what the drivers of violence are, and how is violence, you know, the go-to, or, you know, really the outcome of what we're seeing, and how do we change that moving forward? Because really, you can have, you know, a lot of controls and a lot of laws on the books in place, but if you don't change the root causes, and if you don't change people's trajectory, these are things that we're going to continue to see in the future. So when you're talking about public safety and creating public safety, you certainly have the short-term piece of this, which is, you know, we're going to do everything we can to solve this crime and understand how and why it happened. We're going to move forward and, you know, and conduct enforcement in a really strategic way. But we also have to have the long game in mind and talk about how do you address the root causes. And that's much more difficult and much more nebulous. And it comes down to a lot of different factors. And as public safety, if we don't look at those things, we are really not doing our job, because enforcement alone is not the answer. It's certainly part of the immediate solution. And I do believe we need to get guns off the streets. You're never going to hear me not ask for additional police officers to do that, to keep our community safe. My bigger concern is, how do we change that narrative moving forward?
Right. And we are living with the painful consequences of an increased trajectory in gun violence. In this shooting, 6 people were killed, 12 were injured. The most sensitive and tragic piece of this crime scene were the bodies of loved ones in the street for hours within families' view. Can you explain why that needed to happen?
Yeah, I absolutely will. And we knew how concerning that was going to be to the community. And I, you know, I look at it from, you know, the perspective of being a mom, and how difficult that would be if my loved one were in the street, you know, and this went on for, you know, quite a while. We actually do things a little bit differently than other departments, I think, when it comes to trying to work with the families. Like, we had 2 of our detectives that worked as advocates for the families and really as a liaison to provide them information. We opened up an information and meeting center, and we really try and work with families from the very beginning. So we understand how traumatizing this is. In regards to, you know, having people laying in the streets, when we are processing and we're trying to investigate a scene that is this extensive, everything in that crime scene essentially becomes a piece of evidence, even people's loved ones. And well, I absolutely understand how difficult that is, and my heart really does go out to the families. My job and our detective's job moving forward is to make sure that every piece of that scene is absolutely documented the right way, that we haven't missed anything, that we don't leave any gaps in prosecution. And I really feel like it's our obligation to make sure that we do that right. And so, you know, there's things that we do, body bunkers, shields, and barricades. We worked with the family and the coroner that evening because families were on scene the entire day, and we worked with them so they could be there when their loved ones were removed from the scene. We think that's important as well. And, you know, we've talked to a number of our community leaders and talked about, you know, what we can do to help support the family, knowing that that's really, really a difficult situation, you know, for them. So as much as the prosecution of this case and the investigation is a priority to me, also the health and welfare of our families that are going through something that's extremely traumatic and, you know, and difficult for them. I can only imagine, you know, we try and be very empathetic to them and explain why, you know, and it's just a really difficult situation, you know, for them to experience. I completely appreciate and understand how they feel.
And I understand that that's the protocol, you know, to maintain the integrity of the crime scene and the evidence and the investigation. Are there conversations or could there be conversations that in the future that this could be done more delicately?
You know, I actually talked to one of our community leaders about that and then just moving forward. And we're always looking at ways to change the process on this particular scene because it was so extensive. We knew it was going to be lengthy, but I am certainly open to any suggestions, ideas, best practices, anything we can do. You know, law enforcement is an evolving institution, as it should be, as all, you know, institutions and organizations should be. But I think we have a special calling because we have such a direct effect on, you know, people's well-being that it's really incumbent on us to look for better ways to do things and to try and improve processes. So, you know, when we're talking about a situation like this, a lot of it is developing relationships with key partners, you know, in our area, whether it's our district attorney, the coroner's office, or community-based organizations, and really listening to what people need and seeing how we can adjust to provide services to them. One of my priorities is also professionalism and service. And I think that there's always a way to provide, you know, service in a better and a different way. And I do know that we have the ability to really improve people's life, you know, keep things very neutral and sometimes not have a good impact on them. And we want to move away from not having a good impact to really being able to be that organization that people go to when they need help and they know that we are there to help them. And I think there's a lot of ways to do that.
The unfortunate reality, this isn't the only homicide investigation in your department's hands. Literally, the following weekend, two men were killed by gunfire in Natomas. Do your detectives and officers have the bandwidth to thoroughly investigate and respond to complex crime scenes one week to the next? I mean, is this level of response and investigation sustainable given the trajectory of gun violence over the past year?
We've seen this increase over the last couple of years. Remember, this is also in conjunction with the pandemic where, you know, we are all struggling to kind of move through that. You know, police officers are no different. We're all human beings with families that we're trying to manage. And yet, you know, our officers in our department have been here. We have not had the ability to go home or to stay home. We've been on the forefront of social justice events and movements, the protests downtown, working through the pandemic and certainly the challenges with the increase in violence. I think that it really speaks to the character of the men and women that work here for the department. And even under very challenging circumstances where we're having a difficult time in law enforcement, like many professions, recruiting and retaining you know, quality employees, that they continue to show up to work every single day and they work overtime and they come in late. And you're right, it is a big ask because the calls for service aren't slowing down. The violence level is not slowing down. And I really appreciate their dedication. And it's something I think that often goes unnoticed because it's just kind of assumed there's always going to be someone here to do those things. And it really comes down to a small group of men and women that are very, very dedicated to this community and bringing justice to, you know, families such as ours that have lost so much, you know, recently.
Yeah. Over the past week and a half, there's been this discussion from the mayor to businesses about safety. You know, downtown was bustling that Saturday night. There was a concert at Golden One Center. Restaurant and bars were full and they were letting out when that deadly shooting unfolded. In your viewpoint, should people feel safe to go downtown or simply to go to crowded areas?
You know, I think it's definitely a personal decision, but I do think that we have, you know, we've increased patrols quite significantly in the, you know, really in the days after this, because we do want to provide a sense of security and safety. And our downtown is really, you know, an economic engine for the city. It's also a great place to gather. I love to see that as we're moving into the endemic stage of the pandemic, and I know we'll have some hiccups as we do that, that people do want to get out. They do want to socialize. Our city has put a lot of of made a significant investment in our downtown core to provide this very lively entertainment area. And I know the mayor has come out and spoken about it. We have great partners with the Downtown Sacramento Partnership that are there to create a warm and welcoming environment and provide safety. And we've been in conversations about how, you know, to do that and how to provide that level of safety and security. I was very happy to see a number of people out over the weekend that were talking about wanting to be back downtown and how they did feel safe and how they were looking forward to, you know, really experiencing everything our city has to offer. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester. So we've been talking at length about responding in the aftermath of violence. What is your role as Chief of Police in preventing violence from happening in the first place?
So I'm glad that you asked that question, because when we started to see the increasing trends, really throughout the end of last year, we started looking at best practices, looking at what other cities were doing, some things that were working. And I've consulted with a number of our think tanks in the law enforcement profession. And we have moved forward very methodically on a violent crime reduction strategy. And there's three areas that we've looked at and we've been working on since the beginning of the year. And what I want people to understand, this isn't like, a one-time thing. We're not doing this for press or to put a bunch of stuff out like, hey, look what we did. I'm looking for a long-term solution. And what I would like to do specifically on the several areas, we have gun violence, domestic violence, and behaviors, surrounding people that are experiencing homelessness that have been a significant concern to our community. But specifically to gun violence, what we know is that gun violence is typically committed by a small number of offenders in small geographic areas. And so there are terms that you may hear like focused deterrence. And essentially what that means is there's a number of priorities that we make as a department. What we're trying to do is focus on people that have committed crime or are repeat offenders, and move forward and address those specific individuals versus targeting entire neighborhoods. The other piece of this strategic focus is that we need to work with our community providers. If we're talking about long-term solutions and really bringing effective public safety to communities, one, we need to work with the community so they know why we're there, what we're doing, what we're attempting to achieve. We need to get input from them, which we've already started doing by meeting with community members, meeting with our neighborhood leaders, and then also work with intervention and prevention specialists so that we can have less of these crimes and less of this type of violence as we move forward. And, you know, when you're talking about gang violence, when you're talking about gun violence, it's because something is missing in a community or someone is resorting to that because there's not additional alternatives. And so we need to change that trajectory for people. And that's a much longer term strategy. So you'll see me come out and we'll talk very openly about gun statistics, you know, where that crime is occurring and what we're doing strategically to move forward. You know, if you look back at how we used to do things 30 years ago, if we had a crime problem in a neighborhood, we would send a lot of cops in and we would focus on addressing crime. And we would get, you know, we would make arrests, we would seize firearms. But I also think that we created harm in those communities because it was kind of this like, this one size fits all approach. And that's not what we're trying to do. So one, I'm trying to prevent crime and intervene in it, as well as focus on individuals that are committing the crimes within our neighborhood. So you will see us work with some of our partners, certainly take illegal firearms off the streets, to work with our district attorney's office to make sure that offenders are held in custody when possible so they cannot reoffend. And to work with, our federal partners and other state partners and look for approaches that are individualized to those neighborhoods. And I really appreciate the work that a lot of our community-based organizations do, because I think a lot of that also goes unnoticed. People don't see what great work they do in our community. I think between those two things, that's a great way to leverage what we're trying to do.
Last question. We only have about a minute left. Back in 2018 and 2019, there were zero youth killed by gun violence in the city of Sacramento. And we've been having conversations with the community how crucial it is to have investment in neighborhoods that have long been neglected, from youth pop-ups, after school programs. And what this involves is building healthy and safe alternatives as opposed to working within existing dynamics that clearly are falling short. Building is the operative word. We have you on this time next year. What do you hope we talk about in a meaningful way?
in a meaningful way. I would love to be able to talk about the work we've done with our organizations, with our communities to, you know, specifically address violence within neighborhoods and to have some real success stories to talk about. You know, obviously you can look at the statistics and the numbers. With crime statistics, you know, I think that's a metric, but I don't think that tells the whole story. You know, the population is continually changing, as are the challenges that law enforcement is faced with. But what I would like to see is a comprehensive, sustainable approach to reducing violence and doing exactly what you said, building healthy communities and building healthy individuals. And I think now it's more important than ever. We know that our mental health as a community has been challenged. We know that communities that were already under stress during the pandemic really suffered the effects of the pandemic, probably more so than other communities. And we know what we need to do to bring health to those communities. And so those are the things that we need to focus on. And those are the things that we need to move forward on. In a year, are we going to be there? I don't think so, honestly, but I think that we can be on the right track. But we have to look past year, past 2 years. We need to be doing those types of things to really change what the makeup is in our community and what the resources are available for really long-term gains. And so this is a long-term approach that we're talking about for sure. And thank you for asking the question.
Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester, thank you for making the time this morning.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks for having me on.
Up next, wildlife officials are warning about increased bear activity this spring across the Tahoe Basin following the Caldor fire. We'll speak to a local bear expert about how wildfire impacts the bear population. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Lake Tahoe is shared by humans, nature, and wildlife, including black bears. While opportunistic bears digging into garbage bins and even breaking into homes is nothing new, residents in the Tahoe Basin have seen an increase in bear activity in neighborhoods. In the Tahoe Keys alone, police responded to over 80 bear-related calls between late August and early November last year. Now, California Department of Fish and Wildlife is warning residents throughout Lake Tahoe to expect an increase of bear activity following last summer's Caldor fire. To better understand why these bears have become more emboldened and provide some solutions, we've invited the man who has called Tahoe home for four decades and has intimate knowledge of these animals. That man is Tuji Silch. Tuji, welcome to Insight. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning. Okay, you're not a biologist, but you're described as a Lake Tahoe bear advocate. Can you tell us more about your work and how you help homeowners safely remove bears from their property?
Well, about 20 years ago, I started teaching myself black bear aversion techniques just while out camping or something like that. And it just kind of morphed, and I started studying black bear behavior around town here. And so it's kind of grown into a thing where I'm the guy that people call when they want to get a black bear out from under their house, or sometimes from inside their house or out of their yard. I also do rescues. In the last 5 years, I've rescued 12 different injured and orphaned cubs of the year. So, yeah, I'm kind of the bear dude.
Yeah, I remember meeting you a few years back when I was working at KCRA about, and it was about this very topic. Can you tell us, when it comes to black bears, what do we misunderstand about them? Since you have such a close relationship with them, especially keeping them safe.
Well, first of all, we've got a couple different things going on here, because South Lake Tahoe is an urban wildland interface, right? We have urban neighborhoods. Really, in South Lake Tahoe, our neighborhoods are just islands surrounded by green zones all around us. And then we have the forest to the outsides. But we've come to have these urbanized black bears. In other words, black bears that spend most of their time and life during the year within the city limits of South Lake Tahoe, or within the neighborhoods, surrounding neighborhoods of the city of South Lake Tahoe on the south shore of Lake Tahoe. And urbanized black bears are kind of a new phenomenon in the last 15 years or so. And it's not just an issue here. The human bear conflict is kind of ramping up here in the United States with black bears. And it's not just happening here at South Lake Tahoe or the Tahoe Basin. It's also happening in Asheville, North Carolina, Aspen, Colorado, Mammoth, California. Any of these cities that have an urban area that interface with a wildland area with a black bear population.
Yeah. I mean, and that's so important to take in. I mean, when it comes to Fish and Wildlife, the recent warning about to expect increased bear activity this spring following the Caldor fire, how does wildfire impact the bear population in the Tahoe Basin, or maybe even potentially making them more urbanized?
Well, specifically in this situation with the Caldor fire, really the issue is more so our urbanized bears that were already here. Yes, the fire did push a bunch of wildlife in a number of different directions. And we probably saw some wildland families and single bears moving into the Tahoe area. But the real issue was that when we were evacuated from town for that week, and some neighborhoods up to 3 weeks here in town, our urbanized bears who already have a long time behavior of basically living on human food sources, i.e. trash and other attractants, pet food and things like that. Well, we gave those bears free rein in town here for at least a week, and in some areas up to 3 weeks. And that just gave them this feeling of freedom. There wasn't anybody chasing them off. There wasn't anybody yelling them. There wasn't many cars driving around through the streets. And as you saw pictures, there was bears walking right down Highway 50 at the casinos. So what that did is it emboldened them to a degree. So that's kind of the issue that Fish and Wildlife's talking about when they're making this press release. When you have wildland bears, yes, like I said, we did have wildland bears probably move into the area. As a matter of fact, a wildland family, a mother was hit and killed in October on Highway 50 right by the middle school. And I was able to rescue her two orphan cubs, and they're rehabbing right now at Lake Tahoe Wildlife Care, and they're Thelma and Louise. But it's the behavior after the fire was extremely intense. Now, of course, it dropped off as we went into the winter, and bears started bedding down, going into torpor for the winter, and so not really actively feeding. So it's right now it's calm, and there's going to be natural food sources that are going to be popping up. We've got fresh spring grasses already sprouting. Again, it's a bit early, but we're already seeing bear movement throughout town all over the place. I've responded to calls at a level I've never seen this time of year. Usually between January and May, I get 2-3 calls. I've responded to close to 2 dozen calls already this year.
Wow.
So far.
Wow. And you've said in the past that Tahoe's urbanized black bears, they tend to be heavier, 25 to 35% heavier than their wildland cousins. They often also, this is interesting, I didn't know this, give birth to 3 cubs as opposed to birthing 1 or 2. I mean, is this problematic for the bear population, especially when it comes to coexisting with wildland urban interfaces?
Well, expanding on what you talked about, the difference between an urbanized black bear and a wildland black bear, yes, they're larger. Health-wise, their teeth rot out far quicker than their wildland cousins. They're far more comfortable moving in around, living within the human urban environment. And because black bears are opportunistic feeders, they can survive on a broad variety of foods. And our urbanized black bears figured out pretty quickly that they can spend 15, 20 minutes in a dumpster and get a couple thousand calories, as opposed to spending hours and hours and hours in a wildland natural environment, eating grubs, eating grass, pine nuts, and in the fall, berries, maybe the odd carrion that they'll eat. They rarely chase their food down, black bears do, unless it's a penned animal. But so yeah, and they're shortening their ranges. So what we're seeing is a population density that's growing unnaturally. Whereas wildland black bears, and black bears generally, only have as many cubs as the environment is going to allow them to. In other words, it depends on how much food and water sources they have access to, and their body will decide how many cubs to have. Well, we're regularly seeing 3 cubs with our urban mama black bears here in South Lake Tahoe. Whereas in the wildland environment, it would be 1, maybe 2. Mm. Of course, on the East Coast, you see pictures of 4 and 5 cubs. That's a whole different population, and that's a whole different story.
Now, one of these heavier bears that made national headlines was Hank the Tank for breaking into dozens of homes in the Tahoe Keys community. But that bear now faces possible euthanasia. I mean, is this bear story emblematic of the larger issues that are facing both the bear and human population in the region?
Well, I hate to say it, but it possibly could become just that. The human bear conflict is on the rise. And again, that comes back to our population density of black bears. I assisted on a study a couple of years ago. It hasn't been published and it's ongoing. And it was a black bear population density study here in on the California side of Lake Tahoe Basin. And right now the low estimates on the California side alone of black bear population is between 350 and 500 black bears. Now to put that into perspective, Yosemite accounts for 750,000 acres and has an estimated black bear population of 500. That means in Yosemite, there's basically one bear for every 2.3 square miles. Here in the Lake Tahoe Basin, and definitely within the city limits of South Lake Tahoe, we're seeing a population density of black bears, basically 2 bears per square mile.
Oh, wow. That is considerable. It's a big difference. I guess finally, I mean, and this is the important part. As a longtime resident, you've lived in the basin in Tahoe for 4 decades. You're also someone with intimate knowledge of black bears. What do you want us to know when we come visit? And what do you want residents to know?
Well, first of all, when visiting a bear country, if you get to see a bear, it's a gift. It is a gift to you. But you have some responsibility in accepting that gift. In other words, don't encroach on that bear. And boy, this next fact, I can't stress enough. No selfies ever with wildlife, please, right? And for both visitors and locals alike, because this isn't just a tourist issue. This is a local issue. First and foremost is secure attractants. Don't leave dumpsters unlocked. Don't put trash on top of the dumpster. Don't put your trash out the night before pickup. Refuse collection and pay attention. I strongly urge people not to even use bird feeders. Our wildlife here in the Lake Tahoe Basin has plenty of food sources. They never go without. So I don't really think we need to be putting things out to feed the birds or the bears because yeah. Bird feeders are also attractants to bears.
Yeah, we are an important piece of this equation. Tuji, thank you so much for explaining all of that. I really appreciate the time.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
And that is Tuji Silch, a Lake Tahoe bear advocate, discussing the expected increase of bear activity in the Tahoe Basin this spring following last summer's Caldor fire. Still ahead, we'll learn about a UC Davis Native American series focusing on indigenous peoples and the country and Northern California, sharing their stories of culture, originality, rebellion, and resilience. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A celebration of indigenous culture, originality, rebellion, and resilience. Those are the stories you'll hear at a special speaker and documentary series currently being held at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. The series is organized by the university's Native American Studies Department and shines a light on how Native American communities are enduring and passing on their sacred traditions and stories. Joining us now to tell us more about this series is Dr. Juan Avila Hernandez, Professor of Native American Studies at UC Davis. Good morning. Welcome to Insight.
I just wanted to greet you in our language. We say, may the Creator help you. How happy are you? And were you happy? I hope you were happy until the dawn arrived.
Oh, I really appreciate it. That warms my heart. Thank you so much. What inspired you to organize this series?
I think, first of all, I'd like to say just thank you to you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for the interest and I want to thank our chair, Professor Zoila Mendoza. Thank our guests, our students. Also want to thank the Patwin people, the Kletzaldehi people, the Kletzaldehi people, Yochadehi people, all the people from Native people of our area, Wintun and Patwin and Nisenan and Maidu and just Wailaki, Yuki, all the people here and make original people from this area. What happened was a week before class started, I was told I had the Mandabi Center for a classroom, and so. Yeah, you know, why not put on a festival, take advantage of it to tell our stories, because that's a really important thing that we need to do as Native people, institutions, you know, tell our story in the public so we can be a part of better, have better participation, better recognition for our issues.
Yeah, and you believe this series is also happening at a particularly poignant moment in American and world history. Can you explain why, the reasoning behind this sentiment?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the number one issue right now on a national, international stage is the boarding school issue and the recognition and the healing that has to go with that. The Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, first Native American woman to lead the department, instituted a federal Indian boarding school initiative last June. For the first time, the government is going to take a look and study the impacts of the boarding schools. And the same thing has been happening in Canada with the discovery of thousands of unmarked graves of children at residential schools. So that international dialogue is happening, and we here at NAS and through the series, we want to bring that light and be part of that dialogue and ask survivors of the boarding school to, you know, to tell their stories, because it's really time to do that, despite all of the harm and the pain that's associated with it.
Yeah, we actually had a doctoral student at UC Davis join us last year. One of her ancestors is part of that boarding school, and actually returning her remains to Alaska. It was such a powerful display of work and love for her ancestors. Mm-hmm. When people are going to be taking in this series, there's a variety of things they're going to take in, speakers as well as films. What can they expect?
Our perspective, we're unique at Native American Studies that we believe since the beginning we've established a hemispheric perspective. So when we say Native American, we're obviously talking about the indigenous people of the United States, but we also see our relatives and our brothers and sisters throughout the whole continent. So our first series, our first events started off yesterday, the documentary Haida Modern, about the Haida people and the fantastic art that they do, and this, I'm just in awe of those people. Those people. And on Thursday, Sarah Davidson is Haida, and she wrote a book called Potlatch as Pedagogy. So she'll be talking about her teaching. We're going to have a filmmaker, Julian Brannon, who's a Comanche filmmaker. She show her documentary, Indian 101, about LaDonna, the Comanche leader, LaDonna Harris, and how she really made change from within the system. We're going to have myself and my two other brothers, we're going to be singing our Masobikam, our Yaqui deer songs. So we'll be sharing our culture as well, and telling our history. And then in May, on the 12th, Professor Ines Hernandez is going to be speaking about her project with the Library of Congress to promote novelists and poets from Chiapas, Mexico, and Chile. And that's a really exciting project. And I was a part of that, so I'm really glad to promote that. And our last speaker will be Clayton Duncan. He's a Hintl or a Pomo from Lake County, and he's an elder activist, and he's been he's a descendant of the 1850 Bloody Island Massacre, and for the last 15 years he's been holding a sunrise ceremony for the whole community to heal that wound that hasn't been addressed.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. And there's really something enlightening for everyone over the next several weeks. And it's free to the public. You're also dedicating this series to Professor David Risling Jr., the so-called father of Indian education who passed away in 2005. Tell us more about him and the role they played in opening the doors of higher education for Native American and Indigenous students.
Oh, absolutely. And not only in education, but in our protection of our rights and the uplifting of our people. Dave was Hupa Yurok Karuk, came from a very distinguished family. He was the first, I believe, the first Native American or California Indian for sure to graduate from college. He went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He enlisted in World War II, is probably, again, the only California Indian, possibly Native American, to command a warship in World War II. He was a CB. And when he came back, he was a professor at Modesto Junior College, and he was raising his family. But once his kids were raised in the late 60s, about 67, him and his wife, Barbara, who's it also the series is dedicated to, they traveled up and down the state to talk to Native people because the children were so subjected to so much discrimination, and they weren't, our numbers were going backwards as far as accomplishments and graduation rates. And they got together and formed the first all-Indian conference in California education. Over 300 California Indian and other Native people, but the majority were single mothers, actually. He was just a center piece here and nationally, internationally, of the Indian Renaissance that happened in the 80s, in the late 60s, early 70s. And we just like to recognize him, tell him that his spirit, that we still love him and we miss him. And there was this radical element, obviously, students demanding change. And that was a story also of Native American studies, and from San Francisco State, UC Berkeley, UC Davis, across the country. But the elders who were started it, David Risling, Jack Forbes, Carl Gorman, Sarah Hutchinson, they had a, because they were the World War II generation, mm-hmm. they knew that the institution building part of that was essential. So we benefit from that initial radical movement. And also we benefit from the institutional, and that's why we're still here. We're 52 years strong here at UC Davis.
Yep, 52 years strong. Finally, a lot of people are going to learn a lot from your series. How do you want people to feel? What do you want them to take away?
I think there's things that Indigenous people already know all too well, but the non-Native population might not. And I think, first of all, that we live in a dystopia, in a social, political, economic dystopia. Those laws that regulate us, those manifestly unjust laws, have never been changed, never been overturned or overruled. And now one of the main messages is that we have a chance to operate and to adapt to a new framework through the United Nations Declarations of the Rights of Indigenous People, through a human rights framework. Right now we live in a civil rights framework where Congress can arbitrarily end our sovereign rights through their plenary powers. But under a human rights framework, we have our inherent human rights are respected.
Yeah.
Part of the story of the Mandavi is that 13 Patwin burials were removed to build the Mandavi. And so it's not a happy day for Indian people when we go into the Mandavi, but we thank their spirits and we thank our elder Bill Wright and the people who listened to us and helped us stop those things from happening.
It's necessary. Thank you so much, Dr. Juan Avila Hernandez.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And we have a list to all of the events at that series at UC Davis at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.